Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Faraca. The first known survey of the long-term effects on men of infant circumcision is being conducted by an organization known as No Harm. And joining us this morning to talk about circumcision as a violation of human rights is Tim Hammond, founder of No Harm, national organization to halt the abuse and routine mutilation of males. Tim Hammond joins us by telephone from San Francisco. Good morning, Mr. Hammond.
Good morning, Jean. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
Thank you for being with us. It seems that in this country, circumcision has been for many years, perhaps even as many as 100 years, a routine medical practice.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Jean. This started in the English-speaking countries, primarily Britain, America, Canada, and Australia, as a rather misguided attempt to prevent or cure masturbation among children, both males and females. And that, contrary to popular opinion, is how it got started in this country. It was not started for hygiene or religious reasons or anything like that, but simply to control the child's sexuality.
Now, that's interesting, because certainly that's never the reason that's given to parents. It's the idea of hygiene.
Right. Yes, basically, like any social custom, and we have plenty of medical journal articles that have studied the decision-making process by parents and have found that medical factors weigh in very little in this decision. Most parents will choose it basically out of social custom because it's been done in their family or it was done to the father or they want their son to look like all the other boys. So they choose it for this reason, and they don't even really give much thought as to why we originally started it in this country. And like all social customs, they start for one reason, but you do it long enough eventually lose sight of the original reason, and all these other justifications and rationalizations come up over time.
It just becomes a convention,
yeah.
A medical and social convention,
right.
That isn't really questioned.
Right, right. And this, by the way, is what's happened in many African and Middle Eastern nations as well with female circumcision. The original reasons were lost, and many societies that do this to their young girls very curiously use the same rationalization to justify that for their daughters, i.e. hygiene, disease prevention, to make her conform to the other girls so she'll fit in, aesthetics, these kinds of reasons.
Well, do you believe that they are equivalent practices?
I don't think you can really compare the more severe forms of female genital mutilation to what we practice in this culture, but there are practices of female circumcision which are directly analogous, and that would be the practice of suna, which is the removal of the female foreskin or the clitoral hood. That has its direct analogy with the removal of the male foreskin. What you're doing in both in male foreskin amputation actually would be the equivalent in many ways of cutting off the external female genitalia and permanently exposing the clitoris, which is what you're doing to the male when you remove the foreskin and permanently expose the head of the penis, the glands penis.
And what effect does that have?
Well, basically, the glands penis is a mucosal surface, sort of like the inner eyelid or the inside of your lip, and basically that's intended to be an internal organ. Over time, that skin keratinizes. Most people would use the common word callus. And basically, over time, men lose sensitivity in their penis. And this has a wide range of effects on men, and that is one of the most common effects that we're finding in our harm documentation survey.
What do you mean by over time?
Over time, probably, I think, most men begin to notice this in their 40s. We do have documentation. participation in our survey of men, even in their 20s, who've noticed progressive sensitivity loss. But this process starts from the moment that you remove the foreskin from the infant, because basically that delicate organ of the male genitalia then becomes exposed in the child's diapers to urine and feces and abrasion, and that process continues when he gets older and gets into wearing underwear and jeans, that constant desensitization.
Mm-hmm. When did men begin to question this practice and organize to stop it?
Well, I'm sure men have been questioning this ever since it's been done to them. I think probably that's more of an internal dynamic. In terms of public recognition of this, I don't think that's really come about until just recently because of certain cultural and social factors that have come up. Most cultures that have practiced this have very strong taboos against questioning it or challenging it. In this culture, however, we happen to have benefited very much so by the women's movement, who have taught a lot of men about the concept of body ownership and choice over one's body. Certainly now that we're hearing more about female circumcision, we're getting a direct analogy in this culture. But really, I think as far as organizing over this, men have been sort of shy about doing this because it means talking about the penis. It may even bring up issues of homophobia, that if they dare discuss this issue, it might somehow make others feel that they're homosexual. No Harm was started in the fall of 1992, but prior to that, there was another organization a couple years before that called the Victims Speak, which lasted about a year and a half, and then sort of went by the wayside.
The Victims Speak?
The Victims Speak, yes.
Let me see if I can understand this. In what sense do you feel that circumcised men are victims?
Okay. I would like to clarify that I personally, nor does No Harm, believe that we are victims. Basically, a lot of men who've answered the survey, however, do use the word survivor in terms of a survivor of an unwarranted practice. Basically, you had, as someone who's been subjected to this surgery, you've had a valuable, beneficial, functional organ of your genitalia removed at birth, most times. This was done without your consent. This was done in violation, I think, of probably 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line, we may view this as a violation of constitutional law, because after all, we would not take an adult, we would not take a young girl, and submit that person to a similar type of surgery against their will. So basically, there are many human rights considerations surrounding this issue that we really haven't taken a long look at in this culture.
Mm. Well, here's your opportunity. In what sense do you see it as a violation of human rights?
Well, essentially for the reasons that I stated before, you're having a valuable body organ removed, something that was intended to serve a specific function and purpose in your life, and your body has basically been violated by having that part of your body removed. I'm sure if we were talking about young girls, we would not be questioning the inherent human rights violation.
Well, I think it's an interesting comparison because we have been talking about. It's very interesting because the practice of female genital mutilation is typically done in cultures where they're quite forthright about the reasons for it, which is to control female sexuality, to reduce very deliberately sensitivity in order to ensure fidelity to a mate. That's not the reason why circumcision is practiced so routinely in this country.
No, you're absolutely right, Jean. Basically, I think it's important to note here that almost every culture that does this to their girls does it also to their boys. It's not as if the girls are being singled out for genital mutilation. The boys also are taken, and they have their natural genital integrity violated. That's really the bottom line with all of this, is that this is a practice that adults impose upon innocent, unconsenting children.
Hmm.
And it does affect their sexuality.
Well, what about the ritual circumcision that's practiced by Jewish people?
Basically, there's a lot of dialogue going on right now, as I understand it, within the Jewish community. There are many men and women who are involved in this movement in this country to bring about dialogue and to question whether or not the traditional bris ceremony could have an alternative offered, a non-mutilative alternative to expressing the covenant, and then allowing the male, when he's old enough to consent, to then undergo the more traditional one, if indeed that would be his wish.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any statistics on how many American parents are deciding against having their male baby circumcised?
Yes. The National Center for Health Statistics, 1992, that's the latest statistics we have, found that the national average for circumcision was 60%, which means 40% of parents in this country are not opting for this. Also, it varies by region. Out west here, the rate is only 37% of parents who are choosing this. In other parts of the country, like Northeast and some parts of the Midwest, it can be as high as 90%. And I think that speaks very loudly in terms of social conformity, how much parents feel that they want their child's genitals to conform to the cultural norm.
And what importance does that have?
Well, very little, actually, when you consider it. I guess in a cultural sense, this has a lot of significance, because after all, that is one of the justifications, as I mentioned earlier, that is being used to justify female circumcision in some cultures, is they want their girls to conform. However, on an individual level, we found that men who've answered the harm documentation survey have resented this rationalization. They grew up feeling that they didn't care whether they looked like the other boys. Once they learned the truth that there is such a thing as a foreskin, and once they've discovered what that function and value is, and what circumcision is and does, and the specious arguments used to justify it, they're mad. They're mad that they were altered just for the sake of looking like other kids.
Mm. I wonder what difference it might make to one's self-image to be uncircumcised in a culture where circumcision is the norm.
Well, the cultural paradigm here is that most parents think that their son is going to feel inferior if he is left uncircumcised. However, very interestingly, there was a body image survey done by a men's quarterly back in 1992. The quarterly Journeyman asked men different questions about their body image, about height, weight, and muscularity, and then they also asked them a question about circumcision status. Out of the 197 respondents, 85% of them were circumcised, and the Journeyman found out very interestingly that of circumcised men, only 38% were satisfied being circumcised, compared to intact men who were satisfied at the rate of 78%. And very interestingly, the dissatisfaction rate among circumcised men was 20% versus only 3% of intact men who were dissatisfied.
Is it possible to create dissatisfaction?
I think possibly the dissatisfaction grows out of men who somehow evolve out of their unconsciousness on this issue. Certainly that adage, ignorance is bliss, might have something to do with this attitude.
Well, maybe another way of putting it is bliss is bliss.
Yeah, that could be. It could be.
I'm just wondering how much of a real issue this is. I certainly understand. I understand the argument that there is no good medical reason to do this. But it strikes me that, in a way, you're creating, or the issue is growing out of what has been described as the culture of complaint.
I don't think that's a fair assessment, Jean, because we basically are evolving in our knowledge of what circumcision is and what it does. Dr. John Taylor at the University of Manitoba at Winnipeg has done very pioneering research on prepucial anatomy, that is, the anatomy of the male prepuce, or foreskin. And he found out this is a very valuable organ. What we're finding, then, is that these complaints that men have had have always been there. They've always been there. They just have never had a vehicle for expression. And what we have done is decided to do the first survey of these feelings and attitudes, because interestingly enough, when the American medical profession undertook this surgery, they never did any survey, any research or investigation into the long-term impact of this surgery on men.
Mm-hmm.
And quite interestingly, again, I go back to the analogy of female circumcision, and because this is all very interestingly brought out in a book by Honey Lightfoot Klein called Prisoners of Ritual, in which women she interviewed in Sudan basically are saying the exact same things about what was done to them as we've heard in this culture from men. But by and large, most of the women in that culture do not complain. They do not question it. They do not feel it out of the ordinary. In fact, they grow up thinking the whole world consists of circumcised females. It's only when they come in contact with new ideas, Western thinking about what is normal and natural, that they begin to raise their voices. And this is what's happening in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Survivors of childhood genital mutilation, in this country primarily males, are learning the truth, and they are raising their voices.
My guest this hour is Tim Hammond. He's founder of No Harm, the national organization to halt the abuse and routine mutilation of males. If you'd like to join us on the air, 1-800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. And in Madison or Milwaukee, your number is 263-1890. I'm Jean Faraca. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our first caller joins us from Superior.
Yes, hi, Jean. I just wanted to let know that I agree with his studies that I'm 42 years old and have noticed over the past several years a loss of sensitivity, thinking that it was just an aging problem.
Yeah.
And knowing what I know today, that I probably would not have had both of my sons circumcised knowing what I know today.
Yeah. Well, but how much of it do you think could be part of an aging problem? I mean, isn't it a sort of a natural, a decline in sensitivity, isn't it a natural part of aging?
It very much is. I mean, everyone loses sensitivity in their genitalia as they age. However, that process is accelerated in the circumcised male. Just think of it. If you have a Band-Aid over the back of your hand and leave it on for several days, that skin that's protected becomes moist and extra sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's what a foreskin does for the head of the penis. It keeps that organ, the gland's penis, protected and sensitive. And so if you have a foreskin, with age, are most likely going to be enjoying higher levels of sexual sensitivity, both in the foreskin itself and the gland, with age,
mm-hmm.
over what a circumcised male experiences.
Thank you, Superior. Chicago, go ahead.
Hello, I'd like to comment on your question in terms of how much of a real issue this is. I can tell you from my own story, about a year ago, I started developing allergic reactions. I have a severe skin disorder that is exacerbated by this. Whenever there is scar tissue, the scar tissue is always reactive first. You can't imagine what this has done to my life. I'm not just talking about my sex life. I'm talking about just being able to wear normal clothing. I can't be exposed to chlorine in swimming pools. I can't use laundry detergents. I wish the medical establishment knew what people like myself live with. It is just such a great injustice. It is such a lie. My mother asked me after I disclosed this to her if I thought that that I had received a botched circumcision. And what I wish I would have said, I tried to say what I did respond with very gently, but what I was really thinking the moment she asked me that was, is there an anatomical, is there a correct way of performing the anatomical equivalent on a female? This all has to do with our cultural perspective. This isn't done in Europe, and they don't have problems there. And Europeans look at us as being at least peculiar, if not bizarre. And people don't see this as being necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not.
Do you think your allergies were caused by the circumcision?
Well, the first thing that you have to remember is that the foreskin is protective. But the second thing is that whenever you cut skin, whenever you have scar tissue, the scar tissue is always reactive first to allergens. So yes, absolutely. Both my urologist, my dermatologist, the plastic surgeon I see, everyone believes that probably had I been left intact, that I would not have the problems I have today. And that's only addressing the medical aspects of it. I mean, it's very easy for people to say, well, what are the medical advantages of it? And people don't look at the host of problems that are created. You don't fix what is not broken.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've created damage, then it's very hard to fix. And for myself, you know, I don't know what my fate would have been had I been left intact. But I do know that what I live with, because I was mutilated, is horrendous.
I appreciate what you're telling us. On the other hand, I would have a certain resistance to thinking of myself as mutilated and non-intact, had I had, we've had a routine practice in this country that has gone on for decades. Are we now going to produce generations of men who are going to think of themselves as being mutilated and non-intact? And how healthy is that?
Gene, that is very interesting question, because the same phenomenon is occurring again over in Africa. However, what we need to remember here is that the term female genital mutilation is a Western term. African parents do not consider what they are doing to their daughters as mutilation, nor do the women consider themselves mutilated. They consider themselves normal. In fact, the word they use is circumcision. They don't run around saying, you know, oh, we're mutilating our daughters. That's a tough thing to come to terms with. It will be very difficult in this culture, and I am very sensitive to the idea that what we're talking about here today may be a very powerful concept and a difficult one for people to digest. However, men who have been circumcised as infants are not totally without hope. There is a process called uncircumcision or foreskin restoration, which can be accomplished non-surgically through skin expansion techniques that one does in the privacy of their own home. This is a sign of hope that men can approximate a foreskin. The original foreskin is a highly specialized organ, very unique, and that was thrown in the trash. However, you can approximate the look and the feel and the function of a male foreskin through uncircumcision methods. So we're not encouraging a victim mentality here, nor are we encouraging men to think of themselves as mutilated. On the other hand, we are saying that you have a right to speak up for what was done to you and to try to protect future generations, and if you so choose for yourself, to restore.
Appleton, go ahead.
Good morning, Gene. I'm a little surprised that you're being so insensitive about this. Shame on you. You have to realize that this is... I am not circumcised, and my son is not circumcised. And this is kind of interesting, because the pressure we got to circumcise our son, the doctor said something, what about the circumcision? And, I told him, no circumcision. And he's sort of his old country doctor, and he said a few things, that he's going to make him, different. And I said, yeah, well, that's fine. But the real pressure that we got came from the nurses, from the women. And in my life, I've noticed that men don't, I guess we don't normally make remarks about that, but women have been surprised. And, as yourself, you're saying, well, gee, why weren't you? Why weren't you circumcised? Why are you different? And isn't it enough that we don't like it? Isn't this enough of a reason to stop an unnecessary, what if women started having preemptive mastectomies because, God knows you could get cancer.
Mm. Actually, it's as strange as it may seem. Some women do opt for that.
Well, I know, and yes, I know that that is true.
That,
I just thought I'd throw that out
choice.
To kind of stir the pot a little bit.
Right. And that is their choice, and that's an important point. I guess the questions come out of the change. When something has been considered normal and appropriate for so long, and so many thousands of men lived whole lives thinking of themselves as completely healthy, completely whole, it's startling to have those assumptions challenged. And I think that's the purpose of talking about it. I mean, isn't that the purpose of your organization, is to educate?
Oh, yes. And clearly, Gene, I think your reaction is quite a natural one that most Americans would probably feel. It's like, why the big problem now? And because of the factors that I mentioned earlier, the evolution of men's awareness and the other factors that we've talked about, the women's movement, the sense of body ownership and calling into question whose body is it anyway in this culture, and the evolution of children's rights, all of these things are causing men to think in terms of what was done to them. Mm-hmm. And very interestingly...
Yeah, but see, that's the part that makes me uncomfortable. When you look for reasons to feel oppressed... And if that's what the effect of the women's movement has been, that's the part that I begin to question. I mean, you could probably convince me that I shouldn't have circumcised my sons, just on the basis of this notion of, hygiene. I mean, I can remember it sort of indirectly, the way it was presented as, you don't want your kids to grow up looking like they came from third world countries.
Right.
That sort of... arrogant presumption of cultural superiority.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that really needs to be examined. I know people who are making the decision not to circumcise their sons because there's no reason to.
Sure.
The whole notion of hygiene, after all, Americans are probably the cleanest people in the world.
Well, of course. Actually, your previous caller brought up a very good point that does happen in many hospitals, and that is undue pressure from the hospital staff and perhaps even the nursing staff that you need to have this done. And it comes out of a well-meaning concern for the child's conformity, or maybe even from very serious concerns about the child's health, but these are totally unfounded, as you said. Male personal hygiene is far easier than oral, anal, or feminine hygiene. You don't need special tools, no special products or techniques. It's just a simple fact of retracting the foreskin and washing it with a little water. Very easy hygiene. and it's not an excuse to surgically amputate part of your son's body.
On the other hand, it's hard to get boys to practice good hygiene at certain stages in their development. And when a doctor tells you, you know, you're a conscientious, well-intentioned parent, that this is going to help prevent a lot of unnecessary infections and problems of that nature, that can be a very compelling reason.
Well, it can be, just as compelling as it would be to say that little boys don't really like to brush their teeth a lot, so maybe we could remove their teeth and make their oral hygiene a lot easier for them. The distinction here is that, of course, everybody understands the value of the teeth,
mm-hmm.
but this culture does not understand the value of the foreskin. As one of your other callers mentioned, if you go to Europe, you'll talk to any parent, and especially the men, and they'll say, why would I want to cut that part of my son's penis off? It's
mm-hmm.
one of the most erogenous parts of his body. And in this culture, we don't recognize that yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's so easy for us to say, well, sure, cut it off if you think it makes it cleaner.
Yeah. Sheboygan, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share with you, also as a mother of a son, a more fortunate experience I had in that a doctor, when my son was born in 1977, made it clear that he didn't think that this was a routine thing to do. And we were very confused. We'd heard the argument about hygiene and da-da-da-da and looking alike in a locker room, and pressed him for his opinion, which he was reticent to give it. And finally he said, I consider it a rape of the phallus. And we decided not to. And there were moments that we questioned that decision, and yet we're very happy and comfortable with it now. One of the reasons being knowing a young man at age 16, the same age as our son, who had a circumcision and had to have it repaired. And it was an excruciatingly painful and disturbing thing to go through.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand as a mother, as you are, that these decisions we are so dependent on the immediate input from the so-called experts.
Yes.
We were lucky.
Yeah, and that is interesting, because it seems to me as a people we're beginning more and more to question the authority of the experts.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
medical experts.
Exactly. Thank yeah. you.
Thank you. We'll go next to a caller from Arbor Vitae.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. That's Arbor Vitae.
Thank you.
I'd like to share an experience that I had because of my circumcision, and a couple other comments to make besides the question is, the experience was in a cross-country skiing situation out back on a trail, and the temperatures got a little colder than one would expect, and the tip of my penis became very, very painful because it was very, very cold. And I got to thinking, geez, guys who had that foreskin over there
mm-hmm.
would probably not be experiencing pain in to the degree that we are here.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience was my first emotion, what first became over me after I thought that was anger, intense anger to the people who had cut that off, something that was given to me as a birthright, you know, the way I was designed, cut it off, and I guess what also added to the anger is it was religious people who were doing this to us and changing something the way God made, when mm. the whole time they're teaching us that God is perfect and everything he does is just right.
Well, religious in what sense?
I guess just because it was religious, you know, the Catholic religion did that to us. And I was led to believe that that was a good thing to do if you were a good Christian.
To be circumcised?
Yes.
I've never heard that.
This is very
no. Tim?
Common. This is very common. In fact, you know, a lot of people think that this is, quote, a Jewish problem. It is not in our culture. The overwhelming majority of circumcisions done in this culture are done by Christian parents who believe that it is their religious duty to circumcise their son. Because, after all, remember, Jesus supposedly circumcised.
But that's because he was a Jew.
That's because he was born a Jew, of course. But that fact didn't make it necessary for later generations of Christians to circumcise their sons.
Hmm.
In fact, this was a big issue in the early Christian church of whether or not circumcision was necessary.
Uh-huh.
The New Testament finally came down and said, no, it's not necessary. necessary to show your faith to God.
But you're saying that this sort of popular belief persists anyway.
Oh, very clearly, yeah.
Well, that's certainly interesting.
It's a new facet that's coming out in this whole discussion.
Mm-hmm. Milwaukee, go ahead.
Yes, I would just like to make the point that when we had our son and we were informed by the doctor the benefits of circumcision and the benefits of non-circumcision, that there's a huge difference between female circumcision and African what happens here. There is evidence to show that when you circumcise a child, exactly like you've talked about earlier, you're lessening infection, you're decreasing the amount of cancer. Now, are they huge statistics? The answer is no, there's not. And if you were uncircumcised, you'd probably be just fine. But for them to talk about this mental stress because of an allergy, well, what about the mental stress of people who are in the locker room? Yet we're throwing that mental stress out, and we're keeping the mental stress for the people who are quote-unquote intact. When the fact of the matter is that the numbers on both sides of this argument are minute, and the people who are circumcised or the people who are uncircumcised will probably both be great if our society would just accept them both.
Okay.
Well, I think the argument to that is basically that mental stress is not the entire picture here. I mean, if you have prominent scarring, curving and bowing of the penis, glands insensitivity, and beveling deformities of the glands, which are chunks of the glands that are removed during circumcision, laceration of the penis and the scrotum, all of these physical conditions, these are very real complications of circumcision that result. And we've done almost 66 million circumcisions in the past 50 years on children. That's just a conservative estimate. And the number of complications range from 2 to 10%, according to a report last year in the British Journal of Surgery. So we're talking about 1.3 to 6.6 million men who are carrying some form of physical complication only. From
Milwaukee, will you please explain what you mean by the mental stress?
Well, the couple callers had brought up the fact that they'd been circumcised and they were having problems and the mental stress that they're having, and there was no comment made about just ignoring that. But then when it was brought up about the very real problem of adolescence, children at puberty being in locker rooms, and they compare each other, and if you're one of the few children in America who are uncircumcised, you're going to get harassed. Now, is that right? No. Is that a reason for getting circumcised? No. But the fact is, it's real mental stress, and if you're throwing the one argument out, you should throw out the other argument. You can't just arbitrarily pick and choose which ones you're going to accept and which ones you're not going to accept. Now he's bringing up the statistics of the people who have been circumcised, and there's a huge statistical gap there between 2 and 10. That's a huge number. And the fact of the matter is that if you had cancer or if you had infections, that's a real medical problem too. But again, the facts show that in both instances, we're talking about small numbers, and whether somebody was to be circumcised or uncircumcised, they'd be just fine as long as they had proper hygiene and we accepted the people in either regard.
Tim Hammond?
Well, I don't believe that you can accurately say this is small numbers, because the American Academy of Pediatrics admits in their 89 task force report on circumcision that the exact incidence of postoperative complications is unknown. No statistics are kept in this country about complications, and we are the first attempt to try to find what the problems are, number one, so that we can begin to know what we're looking for and to quantify that. The other thing I want to remark very briefly on is this idea that people will feel different in the locker room. I mean, that certainly is an argument that is used over and over again without any research to support that. Again, this social conformity argument is used in other cultures that do this to their girls as well. So the arguments are the same. the Journeyman survey, remember, said that only 3% of intact men were dissatisfied with their status compared to 20% of circumcised men. That speaks very loudly in the fact that while dissatisfaction during adolescence is only transitory, most of your life you're going to be an adult, and adult satisfaction, I think, is what really is most important here, and that's where we're hearing men saying, as an adult, I really don't like what was done to me.
We're talking with Tim Hammond. He's founder of No Harm, the national organization to halt the abuse and routine mutilation of males. They are conducting the first known survey of the long-term effects on men of infant circumcision. And if you'd like to join us on the air, the number toll-free is 1-800-642-1234. In Madison or Milwaukee, the local number is 263-1890. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Faraca. Our next caller joins us from Madison.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm calling from Madison. I'm a European here in this country, and I'm a professor at the university here and also a physiologist. Now, the first thing that struck me when I came here, I've been here for quite a few years, is that in contrast to what people think here, circumcision is an exceptional case. I mean, if you go anywhere in Europe, you will not find anybody circumcised. So I think speaking about the uniform attitude is probably kind of local opinion about the whole thing. But the reason I'm calling is really that one of our sons here, we were away for a week abroad, and during that period we had a babysitter who didn't realize, well, we told her that she had to keep his penis clean, but she didn't know that she would have to pull back his foreskin afterwards. So she left the little boy with that, and he developed a swelling there, and he was shipped off at the hospital. And without our knowledge, he was circumcised there. We were not informed. Nobody could get hold of us. Now, when we came back and found this to be the case, of course, we were quite upset. But the point is that at that point I did some investigation into the circumcision, the medical reasons for his particular case, why he should have been circumcised. And I also encountered some personal experiences handling or talking to the doctors over the hospital. And the first thing we found out, of course, is that circumcision is no reason for this swelling. There are other treatments one should have done before. The second thing is that the attitude among the doctors was, this is not a big deal. And since I'm a sensory physiologist and dealing with neurophysiology, I looked into that, and it's very clear that this part of the body is very highly innervated. And when you remove the foreskin, you will have an increased thickening of the epithelium on the remaining area, which will create a lower sensitivity. So if the purpose for intercourse is to have maximum sensory input, you certainly deprive the individual of that aspect, or at least you lower the influence or the sensation.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing we noticed was, of course, that the child, as you know, small boys have spontaneous erections quite often, and that's a normal part of the development into being able to perform as adult. Well, before that period, he had occasional erections. After the period, it took something between 6 years and, I think, 8 months, 6 months and 8 months, before we saw the first time he had any kind of erection. So the whole input, you know, which is created by the sensory influence from the penis and the erection as a result of that, was shut down.
Mm.
Major sensory input.
How old is
he? Is now 9 years old, and this happened about 3 years ago.
I see.
And the fourth thing we noticed also was that when we came back, it took him almost a month before he could even have his penis touch his pants, you know, because not before he lost this sensitivity, this very nice sensitivity, which I think is very essential for a male, before the epithelium got thick enough, so he lost, you know, the rubbing on his pants and all that stuff, created such a discomfort. So the fact that these small children, you know, which are circumcised, don't see that there is any kind of negative effects of it. It's just because they are so small.
Mm.
If you do this on a somewhat older child, you will have a major influence, not only pain for a long period of time, but also you shut down the whole sexual reflex.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And another point, which was also when I looked into this, is that at least there is a hint in people who give sexual advice and doctors also, that some of the problems in sexual relationships in this country seems to be related to the fact, let's say, the percentage of problems is larger here, which can be related to the fact that most males are circumcised.
I think that's very interesting.
So, simply speaking, I think the reason why we are doing circumcision here is that the doctor makes a buck, and he thinks basically that this is not a big harm because there is a tremendous ignorance of what really could happen and what is happening when you have an organ like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that contribution. Tim, do you care to respond?
Well, I think he made some very good points here, and one thing we're overlooking also is not only the male's sexuality, but how much this impacts on women's sexuality. I mean, the whole purpose of the foreskin is to act as a gliding mechanism and to enhance sexual pleasure and to retain normal lubrication within the sexual act, that many of the men who reported on their wives' sexual experience in their harm documentation surveys to us noted that their wives noticed things like abrasion and friction and bleeding and lack of lubrication. When these men restored their foreskins, their wives' sexual experience was, we're not talking about mentally, we're talking about physically, much more comfortable and frictionless, much more pleasurable. So we're impacting not only male sexuality here, but female as well.
Appleton, go ahead.
Hello, Appleton?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, I'm really upset about your guest. This is really spreading such a disinformation that's unbelievable. Okay, in the early 1990s, Dr. Hiram Weinberg, while studying records in patients in New York Mount Sinai Hospital, observed that Jewesses were comparatively free from common cancer. It was an astonishing finding. Here was a group who had suffered far less from the giant killer than the other women. So following his lead, Dr. Ira Kaplan and his associates studied their records in New York Bellevue Hospital. We were also astonished by the scarcity of cervical cancer among Jewish women. In 1949, genealogist of the Mayo Clinic noted that 568 consecutive cases of cervical cancer, not a single Jewess was among the victims. I'm maintaining that your speaker is a sign of our rebellious generation that we have raised, because God made this thing good for us, and all this talk about this mutilation is absolutely ridiculous. God doesn't speak about women being, but for the male, yes, it is giving us a commandment to do it, and it is good for our miracle. It's a miracle, isn't it? In Europe, has lots of problems. All these speakers are talking about Europe. Europe has lots of problems. If they would be a statistic, everyone would be surprised.
Mm.
So I'm really upset about listening to all these people coming, and I'm really questioning the benefit the Wisconsin listeners would have from a kook from California. I'm sorry to say, a kook from San Francisco talking about absolute nonsense.
Well, now, we need to get clarification on the connection between cancer and circumcision, because this is not the first time it has come up in this hour.
Sure.
Tim, can you give us information about that?
Sure. The first study to come out to...
We have less than a minute.
...look at this was by Terrace in 73, and he found out that there was no connection between the two. Rockne confirmed this in 88, found that Israeli and Scandinavian women have an equally low incidence of cancer, even though the Israeli men are circumcised and Scandinavian men are not. What we do know is that cervical cancer and penile cancer are the result of human papillomavirus, which is a sexually transmitted disease. this can occur both in circumcised men and uncircumcised men, and the real answer here is in responsible sexual behavior and good personal hygiene, not amputating parts of genitalia to protect people from disease.
Tim Hammond is the founder of No Harm, the national organization to halt the abuse and routine mutilation of males. And I want to thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you so much, Jean.